Welcome to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker State Bows.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox. And before we dive into this episode, I wanted to make a clarification on the last podcast about the Colorado draw. Towards the end of that podcast, we were talking about archery-specific regulations to Colorado. And I believe that there was either Brian misunderstood one of the archery-specific regulations, or I misunderstood the way he had explained it. And if that's the case, then I imagine that a number of you probably did as well. So this regulation concerns the profile of a broadhead. When he talked about the blade needs to be in one continuous plane, I took that as if you were looking at the side view of the broadhead, a profile view of the broadhead, and you were to, the way the regulation reads is, hang on a second here while I grab it. It says, each cutting edge must be in the same plane for entire length of cutting surface. So the way I understood that was that from the tip of the broadhead to the back of the broadhead, if you're looking at it from the side view, you could not have a convex or a concave edge like the Werewolf, which has a convex edge there where the blade goes in and then goes out towards the back edge of the broadhead. The Valkyrie would be another one. A convex would be like the Silver Flame, which at the tip, the blade bows out and then comes back in at the back end of the broadhead. I talked to Aaron Snyder and about this, asking him if he was aware of this regulation. He checked with the local game warden, and that game warden said that we were misinterpreting the language there, which really should be more clearly written or should have a diagram. But what that law was intended to do was outlaw broadheads like the toxic broadhead, where the blade actually curls over, you know, maybe like a helical pattern. So that's the definition of that straight edge. So the toxic broadhead, it's also, they call it, makes meat worms, where because that blade curls over so much, when that broadhead goes through an animal, it actually cuts like tubes of meat or, you know, whatever vital organ that it penetrates, which if you were to make a non-fatal shot on an animal, let's say it jumped the string on you or just made a bad shot and you hit it, let's say in the leg, you're actually going to be cutting a hole where you could like pass a dowel through the hole without touching the sides, rather than making a slit where you would be, you know, that animal would be able to heal with a, you know, like a blade, like a vertical slit or even a three blade, those flaps of skin and meat would close back up again, would heal back up, and then animal would be fine moving forward. Whereas with that toxic broadhead, you're actually cutting a hole through that animal that you could, you know, conceivably look from one side to the other through the hole. And that's what they are trying to avoid with that regulation, by the way I understand it. Some sigh of relief there for guys that are shooting broadheads that, you know, maybe they thought for a moment there were illegal, but they are in fact legal. Back to the podcast. So we're going to do another episode of Patrick McManus. This one is from Never Sniff a Gift Fish, called The Bush Pilots. Mostly what I wanted to be when I grew up was a mountain man, but there was one brief period during the summer of my eighth year when I gave serious consideration to becoming a bush pilot. It was Crazy Eddie who got me thinking about the bush pilot business. He came up with the idea immediately after our ill-fated venture into deep sea diving, which, among other consequences, produced a rare form of hysteria in the Ferguson's herd of milk cows. Not only couldn't they be made to drink, but they refused to even be driven to water. A veterinarian was brought in to offer an opinion, but because he had no experience with the effects of deep-sea diving on cows, he failed to come up with a diagnosis. Had the vet thought to ask Crazy Eddie and me, as people usually did when inexplicable phenomena occurred within the range of our travels, he could have told them what was wrong with the Ferguson cows. They had the bends. Since the reader may have some difficulty grasping the deeper psychological implications of my bush pilot phase, an examination of the deep sea diving venture may provide some insights, particularly in light of that fact that both experiences involved traumatized cows. In my own defense, I must report that the entire deep sea diving experiment was Eddie's idea. I was recruited at the last minute to help with the testing after Eddie had designed and assembled the diving outfit himself. Although the technology of the outfit would be too difficult for the layperson to understand, I will mention that its component parts consisted of an old milk pail, a tire pump, a length of garden hose, and two bags of rocks. Eddie said he needed me to work the tire pump while he descended into the depths of Sand Creek, the test site being a deep hole in the creek behind the Ferguson place. The hole was next to the bank on one side of the creek. The creek bottom tapered up from there onto a gravel bar on the opposite side, where the Ferguson cows came to drink. Through oversight, Crazy Eddie hadn't factored the cows into the experiment. As Eddie and I stood on the bank staring down into the swirling dark waters of the hole, my friend could scarcely contain his enthusiasm. "Boy," he said, "I can't wait to get down there and start exploring. This hole is a perfect place for pirates to hide a chest of treasure. Probably some pearls down there, too, and gold, and..." "Come on, Eddie, let me go first," I blurted. "Okay." While he was helping me on with the milk pail helmet, Eddie said he was letting me go first only because I was his best friend and that he wouldn't even consider doing such a favor for anyone else. I said I appreciated it and slid down over the bank, asking Eddie if he was sure the diving outfit would work. "Yeah," Eddie yelled, starting to work the pump furiously. "But if it doesn't, can I have your bike?" Still contemplating Eddie's little joke, I plunged into the hole. I sank swiftly into the cool, swirling darkness, the bag of rocks tied to my belt working wonderfully well. There were, however, some bugs in the rest of the outfit. The helmet offered limited visibility since the only way to see out of it was straight down. Mostly what I could see was the level of water rising in the inverted milk pail, despite the hiss-hiss of the air hose. Of even more interest to me at the moment was a distinct tactile impression of long, slimy tentacles of octopus slithering about my body. Thus distracted, and since the water in the helmet now was lapping about my eyes, I scarcely touched bottom before setting a course toward the incline of the gravel bank on the far side of the creek. Even though I maintained the calm demeanor I thought appropriate to a deep-sea diver, the vigor of my movements caused silt and gravel to boil up in such a fashion as to effect major changes in the creek channel, or so Eddie later remarked. It so happened that at that very moment, the herd of Ferguson cows was moseying down to the creek for a drink, apparently mildly interested in the frantic activities of the boy on the far bank, but with no expectation of a streaming, slime-covered creature with an inverted milk pail on his head to be emerging from their watering place. As Crazy Eddie later related the spectacle to me, for I was too preoccupied with gasping to notice such things, the entire herd rose straight up 8 feet in the air, reversed directions, and to the accompaniment of a cowbell rendition of the William Tell Overture, disappeared over a distant hill. Oddly, the route of the cow's departure was marked in later years by an unusually lush growth of grass. The wondrous vitality of the swath of grass became something of a local mystery, as did the refusal of the cows to go anywhere near the creek for 2 weeks afterward, despite the manacled exhortations on the part of Mr. Ferguson to get them to do so, and save for him the chore of carrying water to them. Naturally, Crazy Eddie was disappointed in the performance of his diving outfit. "Maybe it was my fault," I said, untying the bags of rocks from the belt. "I probably did it wrong. Why don't you give it a try and let me stand on the bank and pump air? Eddie thought for a moment. Gee, I would, he said, but it's getting on toward supper time. Besides, I've been thinking that maybe I'd rather be a bush pilot than a deep sea diver. As we walked home, dragging the deep sea diving outfit behind us, Crazy Eddie suggested that maybe I would want to go into the bush pilot business with him. He explained how it would work. We'll have this plane, see, and we'll fly hunters and fishermen back into the wilderness. We'll land on gravel bars and rivers and in little clearings in the forest, and the hunters and fishermen will be scared to death. But afterwards, they'll say, boy, you sure know how to handle this plane, and we'll just laugh like it was nothing. But we won't work all the time. Whenever we want, we'll go hunting and fishing ourselves. It'll be great. Already, I could feel myself getting caught up in Eddie's dream. But where will we get the plane? I asked. We don't have any money. We'll have to build it. Of course, we'll start off with just a little plane, one we can get used to flying with and landing on gravel bars and on small clearings in the forest. That can be tricky. Come on over to my place tomorrow and we'll start building the plane. Sounds good to me, I said, tilting my head to one side and batting some creek water out of my ear. I did have some doubts that Crazy Eddie and I could actually build an airplane. As it turned out, though, Eddie was an aeronautical genius. When I showed up the next morning, he had already drawn up the plans on a sheet of Big Ben tablet paper. He said he had based the design on a plane in a comic book story about a bush pilot. It looked swell. Where will we get the motor? I asked. My dad's got an old washing machine motor out in his shop, he replied. We can use that and whittle a propeller out of a board. That sounded reasonable enough. I felt guilty about having doubted Eddie's engineering skills. We'll start off with a glider, though, Eddie continued. After we practice landing the glider a few times, we can hook up the washing machine motor to it and work on our takeoffs. But we'll need to have some high place to launch the glider from, I said. What can we use? No problem, said Eddie. He pointed to the roof of the towering Muldoon barn. Why hadn't I thought of that? I suppose it was because I wasn't an aeronautical genius. The finished plane bore only a slight resemblance to Eddie's design, probably because our escalating anticipation of the forthcoming flight caused us to rush construction. Then again, it may have been the limited supply of materials available to us. Two apple crates for the cockpits, an empty dynamite box for the motor housing, two long pieces of shiplap siding for the wings, a short board on a rusty hinge for the tail, and the rear wheels and axle from Eddie's wagon for the landing gear. All things considered, the bush plane looked extremely airworthy. It soon became obvious to us that the completed plane would be too heavy for the two of us to carry up to the ridge of the roof of the barn, so we assembled the parts up there. The roof had two angles to it, one about 30 degrees, and the other, the lower one, a steep 45 degrees or so. A shed roof was attached to the bottom edge of the barn roof. Near the eave of the shed roof, Eddie and I built a ramp that, once our plane had picked up sufficient speed in its descent, would loft us up into the clouds where we would spend the rest of the day riding the wind. Toward evening, we would find a gravel bar or a small clearing in the woods on which to practice our bush pilot landing. With the aid of a ladder, we managed to get all the parts of the plane up to the ridge of the barn roof and assembled. The bush plane, pointed nose down, was held in place by means of a rope attached to a weather vane, the knot in the rope being tied in such a manner that the pilot need only to jerk an end of the rope to release the craft for its descent. The activities on the roof of the barn provoked much interest among the resident population of sparrows, who kept darting about and offering advice and encouragement. But because the construction had taken place on the side of the barn away from Crazy Eddie's house, his parents, both of whom seemed to suffer from some severe nervous disorders, knew nothing of our activities. Later in the afternoon, the plane, straining at its tether, was finished. Crazy Eddie, crouched beside me on the slope of the barn roof, could scarcely contain his excitement over the first flight. Boy, it'll be great, he said. Just think about it, soaring around up there in the clouds, looking down at the patchwork of fields, all the cars and animals and stuff really tiny-like, and, yeah, I said, you'll have to tell me all about it after you land. Crazy Eddie looked at me, the wind blowing in your hair, the plane sailing along like a hawk. I said, maybe we should both go. The plane's got two cockpits after all. Well, okay, crazy said Eddie said, with what I took to be a slight ebbing of enthusiasm. Say, maybe your folks would like to see us test the plane, I suggested. Why don't you go invite them to watch the takeoff? Good idea. Eddie scrambled down the barn roof and raced to the house where he asked his mother and father if they would like to see us test a plane we had built out behind the barn. They said, sure, we'll be right out. No doubt they were relieved to see that Eddie was doing something sensible for a change instead of getting involved in one of those crazy, dangerous schemes he was always coming up with. When Eddie returned, I was already seated in the rear cockpit. I thought you'd like to be the pilot on the first flight, I told him. I doubt that I had ever heard that the rear of an airplane is safer in the event of a crash, but my years of associating with Eddie had given me certain useful intuitions. About then, his parents, strolling arm in arm, appeared far down below in the barnyard. They stopped and looked around for the plane their son had built. Mom! Dad! Yelled Crazy Eddie. Up here! Mr. and Mrs. Muldoon looked up. Both seemed momentarily paralyzed. Mr. Muldoon's jaw worked up and down, but no word seemed to come out. Mrs. Muldoon sagged against her husband. It was apparent that both of them were overcome with awe by the aeronautical feat accomplished by their only child and his friend. Contact! I yelled. Roger! Crazy Eddie yelled back, giving his parents a jaunty salute. Mr. Muldoon yelled something, too, but we couldn't make it out because Eddie had already jerked loose the knot and the wind was rushing in our ears. Our flight plan worked out just as we had intended. Oh, at first there was some shrill screeching from down below, and I had the vague impression of cows leaping fences and trying to climb trees, and terrified chickens and geese raising a terrible ruckus. But then the bush plane hit the ramp on the shed roof, and we were lofted high into the air. The wind caught us and carried us even higher, and it was wonderful. Far down below, we could see tiny houses and horses and cows in the patchwork of fields, and miniature farmers waving to us from miniature tractors, and there was Sand Creek, like an embroidered line of green and blue, meandering through the countryside, and then we soared higher still and were in the clouds, white puffs of vapor floating up like cotton candy, and it was all very lovely and exciting. Except I had this pain in my body, and my head ached. When I opened my eyes, Mr. and Mrs. Muldoon were bent over me, both of them strangely white of face. They were blurred, too, but because their surroundings were in sharp focus, I determined it was because of their shaking. "Are you all right?" Mrs. Muldoon asked, wringing a stream of perspiration from her hands. "Yeah, I guess so," I said, propping myself up on an elbow. There was a manure pile nearby, and on top of it, a pile of kindling and two wagon wheels. Mr. Muldoon said the manure pile had probably saved our lives. Not too bad, I thought. Any old bush pilot could land on a gravel bar or a little clearing in the forest, but I'd like to see one of them land on a manure pile and live to tell about it. Both Crazy Eddie and I recovered quickly. In fact, the only ill-lasting effect of the bush pilot flight was that the Muldoon cows walked around for weeks afterwards with their head turned to the sky as if expecting some assault from outer space. Crazy Eddie and I used to chuckle at them while we were building the submarine. Well, I hope you enjoyed that chapter from Patrick McManus, Never Sniff a Gift Fish. We'll have more of them coming. And I appreciate all the great feedback on the McManus stories. I will keep them coming. Talk to you guys soon.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Western Bowhunter podcast, please subscribe to the show so that you will automatically be notified when new episodes are posted up. Please take the time to give us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. This will help us in the podcast rankings and will help us grow. If you have a topic you'd like to hear about or a guest that you'd like to hear from in a future episode, email south@stalkerstickbows.com with podcast in the subject line. Too many years have passed me.